Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. About 71% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. The oceans hold 96.5% of the Earth's water, but much of what we know is limited to the shallow waters. Today's guest, Dr. Helen Scales, says we need to pay more attention to the deep ocean because it makes this planet habitable. This dark, deep place reaches into our daily lives and makes vital things happen without us even knowing about it. In her new book, The Brilliant Abyss, exploring the majestic hidden life of the deep ocean and the looming threat that imperils it, Dr. Helen Scales writes, quote, "People are starting to ask more of the deep. Some are asking whether it can solve the problems facing humanity today. Can the deep feed us? Can it cure us? Will it save us from the climate crisis? Others are asking whether the deep can make them rich. Beneath the surface are substances and animals that until now have remained too distant and costly to extract, but that is swiftly changing. As shallow seas have become overfished and exhausted, fishing fleets have been pushing deeper year after year, depleting populations of typically slow-growing, long-lived fish. Plans are also underway to begin mining the seabed," end quote. Dr. Helen Scales is calling for the protection and preservation of the deep ocean. She writes that the deep is the final frontier, the last vast place on Earth to open up and exploit. Decisions and choices being made today will determine what the future will look like. Dr. Helen Scales is a marine biologist, public broadcaster, and author of the best-selling book Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells. Her latest book is The Brilliant Abyss. Dr. Scales teaches marine biology and science writing at Cambridge University and advises the conservation charity Sea Changers. Hi, Helen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for this great book.
Hello, Rose. Thank you so much for having me and for that really wonderful introduction.
Well, it's great to have you. You really have an amazing job. Can you first tell us how you got involved in this kind of work?
Well, I guess for me, it was all about falling in love with the ocean. And that happened at a pretty young age. I mean, I was always, as a kid, I was always a happiest out of doors, which I am actually right now. So if you hear some birds or you hear the wind blowing, I'm actually sitting in the middle of the woodlands where I live here in France. So I love being outside ever since I can remember. But then basically when I was in my teens, in my mid-teens, I took the opportunity to learn to scuba dive. I didn't actually live anywhere near the ocean at that point. I lived in a landlocked county in the UK, in the southern UK. But my local swimming pool had classes and I decided to go along and have a try. And even in a swimming pool, in the chlorinated fish-free world, I really just loved the sensation of being able to breathe underwater. I mean, how magical that felt to me at the time, and it still does. And so then I decided to sign up for classes and I began to explore. Once I had my, you know, my qualification, I explored the ocean for real and completely, as I say, just completely fell in love with that space and with this wild frontier that I was crossing every time, you know, I jumped in the water and saw what was down there for myself and kind of got to join that underwater world for those brief moments of being a diver. So I think really for me, it began from that idea of exploration and being in the ocean and seeing the wonderful things down there that are opened up to my eyes, you know, when I put my head down there. So that's where it began. And it led me to science and to research and to conservation. I very soon became very concerned about the state of the ocean. And then later on to doing things like writing books and talking to people about it.
How did you become interested in looking at the deep parts of the ocean? Because it was interesting to read in your book that about 500 people currently identify as deep sea biologists. So not many around the world.
It's a fairly niche group and a wonderful community, actually. I mean, deep sea biology and deep sea science in general is not the easiest of sciences to be done. I mean, just getting there or getting near to it and getting your equipment and so on in such a place where you can do this is not cheap and it's not easy. So I think that's one reason why it's still a really growing area at the moment, simply because, you know, it needs a lot of organization and a lot of money. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, the draw of the deep as well, and having once got into this sort of ocean space and spent quite a bit of time researching and working in the shallow seas, I think for me, it was just this realization that to be honest, the most exciting science, I think, across the board, but certainly in biology, the most exciting stuff is happening in the deep ocean, simply because we are finding so much out about this incredibly important part of our planet, things we just didn't know before. It's where we're discovering so much more about life on Earth and how it all works and why it all matters. And we do have incredible technologies now to be studying the deep ocean. So it's a time of incredibly rapid and exciting discoveries. At the same time, though, the other thing pushing me into the deep is the realization, as you outlined in your introduction and from my book, is that we're in a phase of really threatening the deep in ways that hasn't really happened before. Humanity is really reaching deeper than we ever have. So, you know, we're discovering, we're exploring, and we're exploiting at the same time. So all of those things are really leading me to the point of wanting to know more about what's down there and hopefully, ultimately, to help other people see that too and to want to really push hard to protect it.
So we'll talk about the exploitation of the ocean in a bit. But first, let's just talk about how amazing all of this is, because to think that people are now able to use technology to see the incredible creatures that live in the dark 24/7 in the depths of the ocean is just amazing to think about. And in your book, you do have some photos of these incredible creatures that just look like they're glowing in the dark, really rich blues and reds. So first, let's talk about some of these facts. You write that on average, the oceans are about 12,500 feet deep, or close to 2.5 miles, which is really interesting, 10 times the height of the Empire State Building. Below 3,300 feet, there are no sunbeams at all. And so where exactly does the deep ocean officially begin?
So, I mean, I think scientifically we consider it to be at around the 660 feet mark, around 200 meters. And that's really because this is the point underwater when there's not enough sunlight for plant life to live, for anything like plants or seaweeds that would normally harness the energy from sunlight to produce food. That's no longer possible. So this is when things are really beginning to change biologically in the ocean, is because we're just running out of light. So yeah, so we're talking about that kind of upper ceiling is around 660 feet.
And you'd have a really interesting example in the book about what would happen if you dropped a marble off of the side of a boat. Can you just take us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I was trying to do with that is trying to help, well, myself and my readers to really wrap our heads around how deep the ocean is. Because it's all very well for me to tell you, okay, the very bottom is just shy of 7 miles. But it's a very long way. And also, it's not just the whole way down the same. There's different layers of the deep that have different types of animals living there. There's different conditions. So it's like a layers in like a sundae glass of different layers of colored jello, if you like. And so I imagine, okay, so we sail offshore on a lovely ship, and I take you out to a part of the ocean where it's very deep beneath us. And we just take a normal glass marble, the kind of things kids used to play with in the schoolyard. And we would just drop it over the side of the ship. And I had a friend of mine, actually, who's a physicist and a mathematician, to calculate for me, because I didn't know how long this would take. But I asked him, you know, how long would it take to pass through these different zones? And he said, okay, so, you know, the first, like that sunlit upper zone of the shallow seas would take about 5 or 6 minutes. And then it would enter the deep for real at around that 660 feet mark. It then falls into the twilight zone, which is this first like real proper part of the deep ocean. And we call it that because it is like during the daytime, it does have this kind of dark blue light to it. Like the kind of this, if you had a clear night and you stepped outside and looked at the sky, you know, after sunset, you'd see this beautiful deep blue color. And it's like that in the twilight zone and getting dimmer as you're going further down. But all the way through the day, you get this sort of deep blue light. And that goes down and our marble is falling for about half an hour through the twilight zone. And then at the 3,300 feet mark, it reaches the next zone. The next layer down is the midnight zone. And this is where there's no sunlight at all. So all of these different rays of different colors of the sunlight have been absorbed by water. And it's like permanently dark. It's midnight the whole time, all the way through the day. This is a huge, great big zone. The marble's going to take another couple of hours, I think maybe an hour and a half, to fall through the midnight zone into the next bit, which we call the abyss. I mean, the word abyss is used quite generally. I use that as a general term for the title of the book. But I guess officially it is around this next zone, which is it's 4,000 meters, and I have to do a quick calculation. I bet 12,000 feet, I guess, underwater. And then the marble keeps going and going and going until if it gets down to the very deepest part, which is the Hadal zone. This is like the Hades, named after the Greek underworld. These deep, deep trenches that we get in certain parts of the ocean. A lot of them in the Pacific. We've got the Mariana Trench is the deepest one. And yeah, that's that point where it gets to nearly 7 miles, and it would take our marble 6 hours to reach the whole way down. So I guess I just wanted to imagine this falling thing going all the way past all these different zones. And the exciting part is that there's life all the way down. Well, that marble is going to be spinning past all sorts of creatures all the way to the bottom.
Yeah, that is amazing. And then you also write, in terms of humans would not do well at all in the twilight zone or deeper, because in the abyss, the water pressure is 400 times greater than at the surface, or more than 150 times the pressure inside a car tire.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is one of the things that makes life in the deep ocean so kind of improbable to us humans, because here we are, here I am sitting outside, the sun is shining, the air doesn't have any effect on me. I don't feel any pressure from this column of air pushing down on me. And yet, once you put yourself into the ocean, that column of water that's above you is very quickly going to make itself very well known to you. And this pressure is going to just ramp up and up, you know, to the point where once you're in the abyss, it's like, yeah, like the car tire is 150 times that, or like an elephant stepping on every square inch of your body. And yet life survives that, you know, and that's one thing that has happened through the evolution of life in the deep ocean, is there are these adaptations to survive at the extraordinary pressures all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. I mean, pressure's so high, we're not, obviously, you know, we would have trouble as humans kind of keeping our lungs from collapsing. But the pressure's getting so high down there that, you know, even cells are starting to kind of split apart. The membranes around a living cell kind of just become brittle and burst if they weren't adapted to the deep ocean, which is what we see in things like jellyfish and fish down there. They have specially adapted cells and enzymes and molecules so that they can keep on working at these ridiculously high pressures.
Can you tell us more about the technologies that are being used to study the deep ocean?
Sure. So I guess there's two things that are happening. One, which is, I guess, always going to be there because we want to put people down there. There's always that exciting element of exploration. And so there is good technologies for, you know, we do have submersibles now, not a huge number of them, but there are technologies now available to put human beings, you know, two by two, usually, or three at a time, down into the deep ocean to see what's down there. And we've been doing that for quite a while now, but we do now have, you know, some pretty amazing machinery which allows people to go down for like a day at a time and to be looking outside the window and seeing what's out there. But then we also have loads of incredible remote technologies. So similar machines, but without humans on board. So it's easier, not as expensive and not as dangerous. But with that, these robots basically are coming equipped with incredible cameras. We've got high definition 4K cameras that are beaming live video up to the surface. So you've got a ship with a team of scientists on board, basically controlling this thing down a great big long cable and seeing what that robot is seeing as it's kind of flying around the deep ocean. It's also able to take things back. It has like robotic arms you can collect things with. You can bring things back. It's got sensors. It's got cameras. It's basically doing a whole lot more than what a human being can actually do. I mean, we're very good at looking. We have incredibly sensitive eyes. So it's actually great to put a human down there because they can see things like the bioluminescent flashes of life down there. But, you know, these machineries, these remotely operated vehicles just are incredibly powerful. And it allows lots of different scientists to be watching the feed and sort of chipping in and saying, well, what's out there, and, you know, naming species. Everything's being recorded. So we've got these incredible archives of really high definition imagery. And it's also really beautiful. I think that's one important thing we're doing with these images and these videos is showing people what's down there, you know, and it's providing that kind of that connection and showing, you know, this is not just a world of slime and, you know, microbes. This is, you know, beautiful, iridescent, colorful life down there. And the images are, you know, you could imagine it would be a coral reef or something. Some of it's so diverse and so beautiful. So we have remote tech, and we have all sorts of other sensors, you know, floating autonomous machines that take themselves off as well for months at a time and measure the ocean and see what's out there. We have got more eyes and better eyes in the ocean than we ever have in the deep ocean than we ever have before. So we are, that's why we're learning so much.
You write about a survey that was done in 2019 with 17 scientists, and it was a three-year survey of the Pacific in an area of deep sea bigger than the state of California, involving hundreds of hours of dive time using the technology you just described. And you write that in all, they photographed 347,000 animals, which is amazing, and only one in five were known species. Some were too small, or the pictures too blurry to identify, but the majority were animals that no one had ever seen before.
I know, it's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, you often hear ideas of, well, you know, there's still so much that we don't know about what lives in the deep ocean. And it's completely true. Studies like that, which are, you know, putting a huge amount of effort, hundreds of hours of dive time, and eyes, as I say, these video machines down in the ocean, capturing what's down there. And they're seeing just again and again new species that haven't been identified. In fact, earlier today, I happened to speak to one of the scientists involved in that study, and she's been back now. She's just got back from another trip to the Pacific. A month-long expedition that they took. They've just come back. And they were taking down these amazing remote-operated vehicles down to seamounts, these sunken underwater mountains, and doing exactly, you know, more and more of the same, just looking, finding these incredible new species. And then the other thing she's telling me, though, is that what they were doing on that particular trip is also going beyond that and understanding more about how these ecosystems actually work, you know, and how do these corals live down there for so long, and how are they getting eaten? And, you know, we're really piecing together these bigger pictures of these deep ecosystems from these incredible technologies that we have.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Helen Scales, a marine biologist, public broadcaster, and author of the new book, The Brilliant Abyss, exploring the majestic hidden life of the deep ocean and the looming threat that imperils it. Dr. Scales is calling for the protection and preservation of the deep ocean. So let's talk about how, as you write, this hidden place reaches into our lives and makes vital things happen without our knowing. Talk a little bit about how this deep ocean really influences the climate and weather systems around the globe.
So we really do have the ocean to thank for making this planet a place that we can live on. I mean, just one simple fact is that the enormous volume of the ocean and the water that it contains is soaking up something like 90% of the heat that is the extra heat that's getting trapped in the atmosphere due to climate change. So that's one thing. Basically, we know already that if it wasn't for a lot of that heat sinking down into the deep ocean, temperatures out on land would also already be something extraordinary, like 60 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it is now, like just unthinkably warm, unthinkably hot compared to the sort of climate change we're facing right now. So already, you know, it's this amazing buffer that we have from changes in the climate. But even before humanity was kind of messing with the climate system, the deep ocean has been this engine of driving heat around the planet and making, you know, the whole thing, as I say, kind of habitable. Because if it wasn't for the oceans moving around and these great deep currents moving cold water and warmer waters around, we'd basically have very, very hot equator and very, very cold poles. But as it is, we have this 1,000-year circulation through the deep ocean, which is taking that heat from the equators, moving it towards the poles, mixing things up, basically, so that certainly places like where I'm sitting right now here in Western Europe, it's very nice and mild. And I think without this movement of heat through the ocean, we have this, especially across the Atlantic, this warm current that licks across to us here over in Europe. If it wasn't for that, then we'd be very cold indeed, a lot colder than we are now. So the ocean is saving us not only from a sort of, a heat that could be building up, but also from certain places becoming uninhabitably cold. So heat is one thing. Carbon is something else that the deep ocean is doing us a huge favor for. It's on a huge and enormous scale, which is very tricky to very accurately measure exactly how much carbon is ending up in the deep ocean. But we do know it is a huge amount. Partly just because of plant life and creatures that are living in the shallow seas, harnessing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and drawing it away, and then falling down into the deep ocean. We have this shower of carbon-rich particles, which we call it marine snow. It sounds rather lovely. And if you see any pictures of underwater life, you might see these kind of white flecks kind of falling down past the screen. And that's this stuff called marine snow. And that's bringing a huge amount of carbon down into the deep. It's what's feeding a lot of most of the deep sea ecosystems. It's feeding on this stuff. And a lot of it also reaches to the seabed and gets incorporated into the sediments. And that's, again, locking up carbon for thousands, if not millions of years, carbon away from the atmosphere. So, you know, this is, it's, there's this sort of intricate dance of heat and carbon and nutrients that's taking place through the deep ocean from the atmosphere into the waters and then down into the deep. And all of that is making this planet of ours, you know, as we know it, the places we know we can live, the places that are mild and where there's rainfall that can keep us and grow our crops. All of this is intricately and intimately tied up with movements and changes that are taking place in the deep ocean. And what we do know also is that climate change is reaching into the deep. We are getting these increased temperatures lower down and we're seeing these changes. So it's showing, you know, really that we're affecting the entire planet with our actions. And it's something that we all do rely on very, you know, every day without realizing.
What do we know about what will happen to the deep oceans with more warming?
This is, it's, we're only just really starting to at least understand the changes that are taking place. And I think we're way off predicting the full impact of climate change in the deep. But I guess one thing that's, you know, coming to light, an important part of this is that even though down in the deep, it's, you know, it's dark the whole time. We don't have seasons as we would imagine them out on land. You can't, we don't have summer and winter and that kind of thing. But there are changes in the amount of food that get down in, that gets down into the deep. This flow of marine snow, which is actually basically dead plankton, things that grow in the surface, uses tiny algae and little creatures will fall down. That's what makes this snow. And there are seasonal pulses in that. So you might get, you know, a bloom of plankton at the surface, and this will cause a flurry of marine snow. A great pulse of carbon goes into the deep. And you see that animals down there, you've got sea cucumbers roaming around the deep seabed, there are jellyfish, things like that. And they will respond to this change in food coming down. So we know there is this connection between the surface and the deep ocean. And as changes take place in the shallow seas, which we know are happening because of warming seas, because of acidifying seas, of the carbon dioxide being absorbed into the water, that is going to be felt lower down. And it's going to take time, I think, for us to really understand. And we're still figuring out what climate change is doing to shallow seas. And it's probably going to take us longer to figure it out in the deep. But it is going to be there. I think those signals and those changes are happening. And people are looking at that. And we've got these long-term studies that are looking at the changes that are taking place, you know, month by month and year by year. And we'll hopefully understand more about that as time goes by.
You write that Antarctic bottom water has been getting measurably warmer, fresher, and less dense since the 1990s due to a complex mix of changes involving sea ice and glaciers calving off the continental ice shelves. What concerns you the most, especially when you look at the melting ice caps?
Well, I think the first thing that always springs to mind when we hear about melting ice caps in the North and the South Poles is the idea of sea level rise. And that certainly is a great concern, as it's going to contribute, you know, enormous amounts to that. But actually, I think on the longer time frame, well, no, maybe not even longer, perhaps, you know, just as part of this changing world of ours, it's this circulation that I mentioned, this idea of moving heat and moving you know, currents around the world, and that those are being driven very much by this circulation of cold, dense, salty water that is forming at the poles in the Arctic and down, as you say, down in Antarctica. And this is a real driving force for these currents that are pushing and circulating heat and nutrients around the globe. And so what we see also is a slackening of this, the power. So that the current coming across the North Atlantic, for example, that has been weaker than it ever has been. Well, in recent times since we've been measuring it. And that, we think, is a consequence of this increased melting in Greenland and this input of fresh water. And it mixes in and changes the salinity profiles and basically is affecting how this whole system is working. So I think what we're set to see is enormous changes in the movements in the ocean, in the way that this whole engine is working. And that's, you know, something that we need to understand more about and hopefully predict, you know, what's coming. And it's just another reason why we have to do whatever we can to keep carbon emissions down.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking about the deep ocean, really an incredible place that is we're just now learning more about, with Dr. Helen Scales, a marine biologist and author of The Brilliant Abyss, exploring the majestic hidden life of the deep ocean and the looming threat that imperils it. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about what we are learning about the deep ocean. Today's guest, Dr. Helen Scales, is calling for the protection and preservation of the deep ocean. She writes about this in her important new book, The Brilliant Abyss, exploring the majestic hidden life of the deep ocean and the looming threat that imperils it. Dr. Scales is a marine biologist. She teaches marine biology and science writing at Cambridge University and advises the conservation charity Sea Changers. Dr. Scales, you have a section in your book about a fish that I've never heard of, but this is so interesting, the orange roughy.
Yes.
Can you tell us, first off, just an overall, the orange roughy? It was so interesting just to learn about, well, and sadly, the overfishing of the orange roughy.
Yeah, so this is a species that many conservationists kind of hold it up as this, I guess, a warning sign of what happens when deep sea ecosystems are fished and exploited, because a lot of the species that live there are just so poorly suited to any level of exploitation. Once you get to know them and figure out what their biology is all about, and that's what's so incredible about these animals. I mean, I should say that their sort of original name was Slimehead, and they were rebranded, as many animals are actually, to try and make us eat them, or people sort of make them sound more palatable. And these animals they're bright red actually do it when they're alive, and then they kind of dim, they become more kind of orange colored when they die. So orange was the color. They have rough skin, so orange roughy is what they became. And these are animals that sort of suddenly in the 1980s and 90s, they became very easy. Well, they're much easier to catch, because what they do is they gather together on these huge underwater mountains that I mentioned earlier to mate, basically. And the technologies were there for fishing boats to locate these mountains using GPS and sonar and things like that. And they could put down their trawling nets and catch just colossal quantities of these fish very, very quickly. I mean, it's been reported that there were a single tow of a net would come up with 50 tons of these animals. And so there was this bonanza, this kind of fishing bonanza, first off of seamounts off of New Zealand and Australia. But what very quickly became apparent was that these fisheries just would not last. And it was this kind of boom and bust cycle that you would suddenly get enormous catches, but very quickly they would drop away within maybe a year or so, or even less sometimes, because basically all the fish were getting caught. And so the fishing boats would move on to the next seamount and catch them again. And basically, all of this was happening before enough was known about these animals, about these fish, the orange roughy, to kind of say, you know, this is a really bad idea. Because now, as studies have carried on, we now know, for example, that they live for up to 250 years. Mm. One little fish, I mean, they don't look that surprising. And they're a kind of fishy-looking fish. You know, they would sit on your plate, a fairly large fish on a plate. But they, you know, they have these incredibly long lives. And they may wait until they're 40 years old to start breeding. And these are the kinds of types of lifestyles for an animal, which tells us, you know, this is not something that can be easy to sustainably fish. You know, what you really want, if you're going to try and do sustainable fishing, is to target species that are very quick growing, that will replace themselves pretty rapidly in the population that's being fished. But these guys are like the opposite of that. 250 years, it's, you know, it's like, it's ridiculously long time. They're hanging around in the ocean, you know, for so long before they mate. They may not even mate, you know, until they're 40. And even after that, not over a year. So they are not abundant and prolific fish. And so are a really pretty bad idea. So it was as we were, as people were exploiting these fish, this kind of biology, this extraordinary lives of these animals was coming to light. But it was almost a bit too late at that point, because by that point, you know, fishing was underway. People figured they could make a lot of money out of this. And so it kind of just ripped through the ocean, through the Pacific Ocean. They began to be fished in the Indian Ocean and I think in the Atlantic as well. And only now it's kind of been brought under control because basically they were running out and we figured it was figured out that this was a bad idea. But there's still a little bit of orange roughy fishing going off of around New Zealand and Australia. But I just wonder if, you know, if you told people, hey, you know, that fish could have been living for 250 years. I'm not sure if, I don't know, is that even palatable? Would you really want, even if you're, you know, not ecologically minded, you might think, I'm not sure I want to eat something that's been hanging around the ocean for that long. But right. So it's an extraordinary tale of exploitation, yeah.
Well, and the numbers are really amazing. In 1992, you write that French trawlers in the northeastern Atlantic caught over 5,000 tons of these roughies. And then after 3 years, they could only find 1,000 tons.
Yeah,
those
they
are just
were just
incredible
collapse.
Numbers.
Yeah, they are. I mean, we talk about these sort of waves of exploitation that took place across ocean basins. Mm. You know, and the catch rates were so high that of course, there was a huge incentive for fishermen to find, for trawlers to find these things. You could make an enormous profit in a very short amount of time and then just move on. It was, you know, it's a mobile fleet. These fishing boats have huge long ranges and they moved on. Yeah, they would take enormously high catches because there was very little control happening at that point. There was not really any quotas or catch limits. And, you know, and they would say, we'll make our money and then we'll move on. And I should say, you know, another aspect of this is not just the impact on the orange roughy themselves, but the kind of the really tragic side in terms of the ecology is that these seamounts where these fish aggregate to spawn and to mate, a lot of them are covered in these exquisite ancient forests, really, is one way to describe them, but animal-made forests growing from corals and sponges, these intricate deep-sea creatures that can live for thousands of years. And again, like even longer lived than the fish themselves. And they're very delicate, and what these trawling, huge, heavy, heavy trawling nets would do is basically obliterate these ecosystems. And it's been quite hard to actually assess the damage that this fishing has done, because often people wouldn't go look at these seamounts before fishing began. But the evidence was there in the nets, you know, where they would go to a new seamount and bring up these great big tree-like structures of these deep-sea corals and then pitch them over the side of the boat. You know, that there weren't actually, you know, any use to anyone really. But then after a while, you know, you trawl a few more times and the corals would run out because they basically had all been felled. So there was an extraordinary level of ecological and, you know, environmental damage was being caused by this fishing, this type of fishing. And there have been some studies in the Pacific showing that even decades after fishing has stopped, there's very little sign of a good level of recovery of these coral ecosystems. So, you know, it really is the equivalent of just cutting down those forests and they don't grow back.
Right. This is such an amazing story. And we're just talking about one fish. And yet when you think about these deep trawlers and the damage that has been done over the years, I mean, it's really incredible. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Stephanie in Los Altos. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, it's been just mind-blowing for us in our household to watch some of the live broadcasts of the kind of scientific explorations that Dr. Scales was describing earlier. And I wonder if she might say a little bit more about what great opportunities we now have to watch the scientists work at these incredibly deep, dark levels in the sea, and how beautiful and amazing the things that they are coming across really are, and tell people how they can watch, because I think what she's described so well in words is also it's inspiring to watch it on your computer screen.
Stephanie, that's such a wonderful thing to point out. I am an enormous fan of these live broadcasts. I say that, but also whenever they're on, I get very little work done because all I want to do is watch these broadcasts. So basically, yeah, I would encourage you very strongly. I think we've just finished one expedition that's been happening in the Pacific, the one I mentioned earlier. And yeah, I mean, several of them, the Schmidt Ocean Institute has these, has a program, NOAA has a program, whereby these remotely operated vehicles sending down with these amazing cameras broadcast over the internet. So anyone can tune in over YouTube, over their websites and watch what's happening. And the scientists are there discussing what they're seeing, telling us all about what's down there. And it's in real time, which is just, it really does, it's just an extraordinary insight. You know, you can sit there at home and you can see an octopus on the other side of the world hunting for its dinner. Or you can see these beautiful jellyfish or wherever they may be. All these animals are, you know, in these ecosystems are there in front of your eyes. And you get to see the time it takes. I mean, these dives take 12 hours at a time. So often I'll kind of tune in and out and, you know, they're still there doing this science. So absolutely. I mean, I would say there's, I put a list of resources at the back of my book, actually. There's a few pages there which show where to go to watch these things. It's the kind of thing I'm always tweeting about. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Helen Scales, and I'll always put messages out of what's happening on any particular day. And I know there's a great community of deep sea biologists online who are, you know, busy sharing all these great broadcasts. And actually, a lot of them are online as archives too. So if you want to watch back, you know, if you're not there at the time, there's an enormous amount out there of these incredible views into the deep. And yeah, I'm so glad that you're enjoying them, Stephanie. That's wonderful.
Stephanie, you reminded me of a video that so many people shared a couple of years ago, and I just found it from National Geographic. It's called Adorable Googly-Eyed Sea Creature Puzzles Scientist. And it was 900 meters below the surface of the water off the coast of California. It says, is it a cuttlefish or an octopus? Stare into these googly eyes as you watch the video. And it's this cute little purple creature that looks like a little cuttlefish / octopus. And Helen, so many people, I remember, shared this video because this little creature is just so adorable.
I know exactly the one you mean. It is. It's completely wonderful, isn't it? The other one that's just happened lately, and again, it was this wonderful scientist I spoke to today, Randy Rojan. They had this glass octopus that's done the rounds of the internet just in the last couple of weeks. So if you haven't seen the glass octopus, I urge you to search for that one. It's different. It's not as cute, but it is, I think, exquisitely beautiful. It's this transparent creature. You can pretty much see through it. It does look like it's made out of glass. It's absolutely exquisite.
Wow. It really amazing. Thank you for that email. Before we get into the exploitation, I also wanted to ask you about the sperm whale, because the story you tell about sperm whales making regular dives for an hour or longer and spending more than 3/4 of their lives hunting is just incredible. They're one of the deepest diving species.
Yes, they are. I mean, there's a couple others that we know go down regularly down to around 2,000 meters, so 6,000, 7,000 feet. But for sperm whales, we know a lot about this incredible life they live. So, I mean, I wrote about them, you know, because of this wonderful, rich biology that we know about. But also, I think for me, they're this really wonderful emblem that connects us to the deep, because, you know, we think of, well, we see whales at the surface. You know, I was lucky enough when I was just recently in the Gulf of Mexico to see sperm whales diving, leaping into the air. And, you know, they were visible from the sea surface. And then down they went and they disappeared. And just to imagine that they go down into these deep depths and are completely adapted to hunting and to surviving for an hour at a time at crushing depths in the complete darkness. And we know really a lot about how they do it, and which is just wonderful. We know it was a big puzzle for a long time. You know, what are they doing? How are they hunting? But we now know that they're basically the kind of giant aquatic versions of bats. They use echolocation. They make these incredible sounds which interrogate the darkness down in the twilight zone and even down into the midnight zone. They send out these pulses of sound, and they're listening back for echoes coming off of their main prey, which is mainly enormous squid, jumbo squid, and maybe even giant squid is what they're after. And they're listening for echoes of that, and then chasing after them. You know, people, scientists have basically stuck the equivalent of kind of, you know, the motion sensor on a smartphone. And that kind of thing, or on a GPS tracker onto these things, onto these whales, and tracked these chase scenes through the deep, dark depths. And they're spinning and turning and chasing after and firing out pulses of sound to detect and chase after these squid. And then they do a handbrake turn at the end, and they suck the squid in and swallow it down. And then they carry on, and it's sort of squid to squid to squid. And they hunt, you know, I think it's about at least a ton. I mean, they can come up with a ton a day, I think, or more of squid that they eat. It's an enormous enormous feasting goes on amongst these incredibly well adapted sperm whales. And you know, and they're keeping going down there because they have all this oxygen stored in, not in their lungs — their lungs actually collapse pretty quickly under the pressure — but it's all in their blood and in their muscles. They have this incredible store, oxygen store, with this molecule. Actually, we have hemoglobin in our blood, and they have something called myoglobin in their muscles. It's a slightly different molecule that locks onto oxygen, and they have absolutely loads of this in their bodies, 10 times as much the amount of it than that mammals do that don't dive. And so much so, in fact, that technically these animals should be stiffened by this incredibly high concentration of this oxygen-binding substance. But they've evolved a special version of it, which is actually kind of, it's like a non-stick version, which means they can stay supple and they can swim around and be absolutely fine for a good long hour before these sperm whales come back up to the surface and restore their oxygen supplies in about 7 or 8 minutes, just of quickly breathing, and then they can go back down and hunt again. And they spend, yeah, 3/4 of their lives at least down in the deep, dark depths. So I think that's basically where they live, pretty much. They're just visitors to the surface very briefly.
Wow, really incredible. Today we're speaking with Dr. Helen Scales. We're talking about her book, The Brilliant Abyss, Exploring the Majestic Hidden Life of the Deep Ocean and the Looming Threat that Imperils It. We've only got about 10 minutes left, so let's try to go through the exploitation part pretty quickly. I just wanted to also mention that you have a really important section in your book about plastics, and we've done a lot of shows about plastics. It is even ending up in the deep, deep ocean. You write about Victor Vescovo, who descended almost 7 miles into the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench. When he looked out the window, he saw a plastic bag and a bunch of candy wrappers, which is just a horrible visual. But we all need to know this, because we know that plastic is going into the deep, deep parts of the ocean. But let's spend the rest of our 10 minutes on mining, and then the technology that is being used for renewable energy and how that is affecting and could further affect the deep ocean. When you wrote this book midway through 2020, you said that no commercial mines are operating on the deep sea floor. Is that still the case?
It is still a case. But we are a step closer to mining becoming a reality a bit sooner than I think it was a year ago when I wrote that. You know, things are moving quickly, and companies who do really want to start mining the deep sea are still very intent on doing that. And we could see it happening within the next few years.
Tell us about the International Seabed Authority that has the duty to oversee all extraction and mining activities on the seabed of the high seas.
Yeah, so this is a United Nations body, and they have an extraordinary remit, really. I mean, this is a single body that oversees, as we mentioned at the top of the show, more than half of the planet is 70% of the planet is covered in ocean, and half of that is deep ocean. And they are basically charged with looking after the seabed in that area of the deep ocean. We call it the high seas, those bits of the ocean that are beyond national boundaries. And it's an enormous single part of our interconnected part of our planet. And so they have two jobs, really, although one is at the moment seemingly more prominent than the other, which is to facilitate deep sea mining. They're there to put it in place. So it's up to these officials at this organization to hand out prospecting permits to companies who want to go see what's down in the deep ocean. So they're giving out prospecting permits to enormous areas, 75,000 square kilometers. I don't know whether that's in miles, but it's a lot. huge areas of these chunks of the seabed, which are being given over to countries that are members of the International Seabed Authority, the ISA have member states, and they can bid for these prospecting permits, and they're being handed out, and that's all happening. There's, I think, dozens of these things now. These permits have been handed out, but so far no one has got a mining permit, which is what you would get after the prospecting has happened. So we're in the prospecting phase right now, and it's up to the ISA, it's up to the people there to decide if mining should go ahead, and if so, how. And right now we're in a very important stage because the regulations, the rule book, if you like, for mining is currently being written. The ISA is in charge of deciding how it happens, how it's going to be regulated, how are they going to decide how any environmental impacts are going to be avoided, because that's the second part of their job. So one is to oversee mining, but the second is they are committed to making sure that mining does not have any significant harm to the seabed. This is written into law, into the international law of the sea. We have regulations saying that if mining is to happen, it's not to cause any significant harm. And that's where things get tricky. Because at the moment, it's very hard to be able to say if that is actually going to be possible for mining to happen without causing extraordinary harm to really important deep sea ecosystems.
Right. And you have to wonder who's really going to be calling the shots here, because we know that so many of these types of organizations, groups exist, and yet there's no enforcement mechanisms and there's so much money involved. And for example, yeah, in this case, seabed mining would happen because corporations are calling the shots. So what are your thoughts on how that's going to play out?
Yeah, it's a worrying time and an interesting time. I think we're going to see some big changes taking place in the next few years. I should say that seabed mining is something that's been on the cards for decades. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s is when people first started getting the idea, certainly on abyssal plains, these great big areas of the deep sea, which have these metal-rich rocks lying around. And this was the first time it was thought, you know, maybe we could pick those up and use the metals inside them. Perhaps they've got, you know, and there's useful, valuable metals there, there's no doubt. But, you know, that first wave of interest, which kind of peaked in the 80s, faded away because the technologies weren't there and the prices weren't quite right and it was going to be too expensive to do this. And now we're in the second wave, and it's being driven, again, you know, with a profit motive very much in mind. These big companies surely are looking to do this, you know, to make a lot of money at a time when, you know, there are predictions that some metals are going to become harder and harder to mine out on land. How much that is true, I think, remains to be seen. There is also this idea and the story, which actually really was something I wanted to look at in the book and spend some time really digging into, because a lot of the time what we're hearing from these mining companies who desperately want to do this is that the reason they're doing it is to save the planet, to save us from climate change, because those metals are going to be used to make the kinds of devices that we will need to give up our carbon habits. So for renewable energy devices, for solar panels, for wind turbines. And critically at the moment, one of the big arguments is for making the batteries for electric vehicles, rechargeable batteries. And so that's why they're doing it. And this is, it's tricky, because that's a very appealing idea that we do need, you know, we need metals and this is one place to get them. But it's really a complex matter. And I would say, you know, there is so much more than simply, you know, these are the metals that we need. We have so much that's going to happen in terms of the technologies that we're using, the specific elements and metals that go into those things and how we use them, you know, how we're actually manufacturing these devices and reusing them and recycling them. This idea of closing our economies and our manufacturing to be closed loop as well, it's all in the picture. But I think at the moment, as you say, coming back to these corporations, the argument is being very pushed. It's being very forcefully pushed through that this is a very black and white situation, or if you like, a blue or green situation, which is to say, the only way we're going to, you know, the story we're being told is that it's going to be better for the planet to mine these deep sea metals than on land. And we just simply can't say that right now. We don't have the science to say that it's even comparable to compare mining on land to the deep sea. And yet, so it's meaningless to say it's going to be better. We just don't know. It could be an awful lot worse for all those reasons we've been talking about, the carbon that's being locked up, the importance of these deep sea ecosystems. So, that you know, I think there's a lot to be discussed. And what I really want to do with the book is to show more people what's going on, to kind of lay out this debate of what we need at the moment, what humanity is going to be using in the future, and where we're going to get that from, because it's not a done deal by any means. Deep sea mining, some might want to make it seem like it's inevitable, but it really isn't. We still have a lot of choices to make, and we're still a way off this actually happening. And a lot of scientists, myself included, are increasingly calling for a moratorium. What we want is a pause in this so we can really make the right decisions, and so the science can happen first before the exploitation. And it would be a wonderful thing if we could just say, let's just wait and see and learn more before we start doing this.
What can people do if they are concerned about this issue and what's to come?
So first up is educate yourself, learn about this. I mean, read my book if you would like to. I would love you to have a look at that. But also there's a lot of writing online at the moment. There are a lot of articles. People are saying, you know, what's going on in terms of the science, in terms of the economics and all the other aspects. So go out and find out more about this and find out, be interested, and listen and look at what's happening in the news, because more is happening all the time. We're getting lots of advances in terms of different companies and different countries getting involved. So do that. Be interested. Talk to your friends. Talk to your family. Make it something that is, you know, it's current and it is relevant to all of us. And then you can also put pressure. You know, if there's something, if you feel passionate about it, we have representatives who are at the ISA, who are at the United Nations, who could also put pressure on a moratorium. You know, they speak for us. They speak for all of us. And if we have strong views, we can make that, you know, and get them to listen to us.
And Leslie writes, is there a European Union consumer guide for sustainable seafood shopping and dining like the Seafood Watch Guide offered by the Monterey Bay Aquarium?
Yes, there is. Yes, certainly in the UK, and I think it's a pretty good one for Europe generally, is there's a Marine Conservation Society have a good fish guide. It's tuned into UK diets, but I think it covers some of the other European ones too. So I would definitely recommend that. So the Good Fish Diet, Good Fish Guide from the Marine Conservation Society.
Dr. Helen Scales is author of the new book, The Brilliant Abyss, exploring the majestic hidden life of the deep ocean and the looming threat that imperils it. Dr. Scales is a marine biologist who teaches marine biology and science writing at Cambridge University. Helen, thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful chatting with you.
Thank you. You too. And one more thing we learned in Helen's book, most current designs for rechargeable batteries for electric cars and trucks requires a lot of cobalt. And this is found in the deep ocean. More than half of the global cobalt supply comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Central Africa. So we will definitely do a show about this because that deserves more attention. You can find more about Dr. Scales' work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.